Number two is
just
make sure,
wow.
yeah. Number two, I'd say make sure you pay your bills on time. So again, it sounds like a given, but you'd be surprised how many people I know, friends personally, who don't pay their phone contracts on time and let it elapse and say, I'll pay it 3 weeks later. Try and pay those on time. Like I say this all the time, if you can, and you know, maybe your phone contract's coming up and you don't have money, you'd be better off borrowing from a friend or borrowing from a family member or someone close to you to pay that phone contract and paying them back than missing that payment, because that will have an effect. And people don't always, you know, believe me when I say that. I'll say, if you've ever missed a phone payment, go ahead and look in your credit file. You will see it on there. I promise you, I had a look and there was one.
I am Daniel Itomi, your host, and welcome to the 20-something Experience podcast, where we listen and learn from the lives and experiences of young adults across the world.
Hey guys, we're back again on another episode, and this time we're talking about everyone's favorite topic to hate, money and our finances. And as younger adults, it's important that we understand how money works and how best to use it effectively. And I actually saw a good post by you on LinkedIn about the misconceptions of how young people are with money, and we're not as bad as we think. However, there's a lot that we don't know, and we're not told about taxes, mortgages, loans, gross and net salary, money saving tips, financial jargon, and so much more. And I've got probably the best guest possible. She's a finance guru, and she's worked with big brands like Fiverr, Monzo, and Barclays, and she has an amazing podcast on financial literacy, and her name is Kier, and she's the founder of the Pennies to Pounds podcast. How are you doing today?
I'm good, thank you. Thank you so much for having me. I'm super excited to be here.
Thank you. We're so happy to have you. So tell us a bit about yourself. How did you get into financial literacy?
Yeah, okay. I'll try and keep like my whole life, put it down to like a couple of minutes. to put it really, really summarize it quickly. My parents taught me about finances from a young age. So as I was growing up, I always knew about savings and everything. And then I got to university. So I actually left home for university and I moved away about 2 hours away from home. And that's where kind of like the lessons that I was learning were actually put into practice. And it's safe to say that I did make some mistakes because I was young. So I did find myself
yeah.
and stuff, but nonetheless, I got myself out of those situations. And along the journey, I kept finding that my friends would come to me for different questions. So I wanted to understand how this worked, that worked, because many of us moved out as well. So they'd come to me and I'd help them. And I realized, you know what? If my friends are having issues and we're all around the same age, all like 19, 20, there's got to be other young people who are in the same boat. So I started a YouTube channel in 2018, talking about personal finance and, you know, how credit cards work, mortgages, all those kind of things. It didn't take off the way I wanted. So I put it on pause. I didn't give up. And then it was a year later, actually, in October 2019, on Twitter, I made a thread about the Help to Buy ISA in the UK, which is now closed. But at the time, it was closing. So I made a thread about it. That thread went viral. And then from there, I was like, oh my gosh, I found my platform. I know what I'm doing. And I started my podcast first. So that was taking off really, really well. Going to 2020, had my first ever finance event. Which was sold out. I had like 150 people turn up, which was incredible.
Wow.
And then March, as we all know, across the globe, March is when, well, at least in the UK anyway, we went into lockdown. So that is where my podcast went from just a podcast to a whole platform where we launched the website. We've got all the social channels. And there's a lot more of a demand, sorry, for the platform and the information that I was giving. So I worked with loads of brands. You mentioned some there, Fiverr, Monzo, Barclays. I've worked with NatWest. I've worked with all the finance brands that you can think of. I've probably worked with them all on the horizon to create content with them to educate young people.
Wow, I wish I had like more hands to clap for you, because that is quite the portfolio. Oh my days. How old are you?
I'm 23. I turned 23 last month.
Oh my God, you've achieved a lot. You should be proud of yourself.
Thank you so much.
This is just the beginning, I can imagine. Like, wow, yes. There's so much in your future. Wow. Thank you for always educating all of us on money. And obviously how I found you was actually a post. I connected, but also that your post about the misconceptions of young people and money.
Yeah.
But do you think young people are genuinely bad with money, or is it just a major misconception? And why is that, if so?
That's a really good question. I think it's, in this new generation, I think it's somewhere in between the two. I think some young people are bad with money. And I think it is a misconception. I'll explain both. So I say some people are bad with money, some young people. But I wouldn't necessarily always blame them. I think we are, as children as we grow up and then we become young adults and adults, we are sponges. So we absorb whatever's around us. And when I was growing up, it might sound like I'm super old, I'm not, I'm only 23, but at least when I was growing up, social media was still very new and I didn't have social media until I was like 15, 14, 15. So when I was younger, I was just absorbing what my parents were giving me, which I told you were the lessons, and absorbing what my friends were doing. That's what I was soaking up. Now the younger kids coming up, so my brother's younger than me, he's lived on social media. That's all he's known. So when you're on social media and you see all these big rappers and artists who are spending money like crazy and buying designer gear, you want to emulate that. And that's just how we are. When you're children, you want to just copy what you see and what you idolize. So if you're not necessarily getting those lessons from home, which some people aren't, and it's not to blame the parents, you know, all the time, but some parents just don't know, so they can't give those lessons to their kids. But if that is what you're soaking up, then that's what you're going to start. Kind of like copying, and you will start being bad with money. But I also think it's a misconception, because as someone who talks to young people on a daily basis from across the globe, I can tell you that young people, more than I say some older people, are really into their finances. Super into their finances. Like, it's absolutely crazy how many people have gotten like X amount in savings. People who are thinking about investing already. I've spoken to like 19-year-olds who always started investing. Young people are really on it, and I think there's not enough credit always given to young people. I think especially in the media, it's perceived that, oh, you're young, so you're just spending money on this, you're just wasting money on that. And it's like, no, actually, I speak to a lot of adults who are in thousands of pounds worth of debt, and young people who are like, you know what, I don't want to get into that realm, I'm making sure that I'm being smart now. So I think it's a mix of the two.
Definitely. And we're deep into the information age. So a lot of the things that a lot of the adults probably didn't know, a lot of young people would know now. So you could have 18-year-olds that are like actively investing because they know the value of money. They know the value of investment. So they know that they need to invest in order to be like secure in the future and not and not be in trouble and have thousands and thousands of pounds in debt. But whose fault do you think it is for young people not knowing enough about money? And I'm not even talking about saving money, but things like taxes and student loan repayments and all of that. Is it the young people's fault, or is it just like whose fault is it?
I am going to say that, in my personal opinion, I think the responsibility lies with the government. So the government in, you know, native countries, I can speak for the UK. But I say that because I know when I was in school, I learned so much. And I know some people say, oh, I went to school, I learned things which I never used. I can't tell you a single thing that I haven't used in some capacity. I learned so much. And one of the most key things that, you know, young people, you don't realize that you need until you get to adulthood, wasn't taught in schools, and that was finances. And I recall having one lesson in sixth form. So it wasn't even in you know, main schools, in sixth form. And I only got a lesson because I studied economics. So if you didn't study it, you didn't get a lesson. And I had one lesson explaining how taxes work and what income tax is and all the kind of that, breaking all those things down. And I remember all of our mouths dropped in that lesson because we were like, oh my gosh. And I remember our teacher like caveated the beginning of the lesson saying, this is probably the only lesson you're ever going to get in your life before you touch adulthood about finances. So I'm here to give it to you. And by the end of the lesson, we're like, I can't believe we will never get taught this again, because like there's so many things that you just don't know, you don't realize that you don't know. And there's lots of people who go out into the wide world and you're made to feel like you're prepared for the world. You know, you've gone through the schooling system, maybe you've gone to apprenticeship, maybe you've gone to university, but regardless, you've come out the other end and you're meant to be ready for this wide world, but no one tells you how to manage bills, no one tells you how to rent, no one tells you how to go and buy your first house, no one tells you anything, but you're expected to learn it yourself. So I would put the onus on the government personally.
Facts. I agree. I think there needs to be more systems that focus on this, you know, because I always say that I think so far, I'm 24. I haven't used Pythagoras theorem to, you know, pay for anything. So, you know, exactly. It's like for people that like I was purely a science student, so I never went anywhere near economics. But if you were, then you're lucky. If you weren't, then, oh, well, you figure it out on the fly. I don't think it's supposed to work that way. So effectively, exactly. So we'll move on to like for uni students, especially graduates, when they're applying for jobs, what do you think they should know about taxes, like council tax and their salaries?
Oh, it's a good question. Okay, so what I'd say for graduates, I've seen this kind of come up a lot on social media, because I'm very much on there. I find it interesting to see what people talk about. But I've seen a lot where people say, oh, you know what, I wouldn't apply for a job that's 40k because you get taxed more. I would stay under this bracket. And what I'd say is, in terms of social, again, I'm only speaking about the UK, but in terms of how taxes work, what I'd say to you is that everyone across the UK, we get something called a personal allowance. So that means up until a certain threshold, that income is tax-free. Right now, I do believe that personal allowance threshold is £12,500. So that means your first £12,500 of income is completely tax-free. Then after that, so the difference, so any money over that, so £12,501, up until £50,000 is taxed at 20%. Okay, so it's not the whole amount, like I hear people say. People say, oh no, I wouldn't do that because I lose X amount of money. It's just the difference between the personal allowance and the top of the first threshold, 50K. And then I do believe it's 50,001 pound all the way up until 150K, you get taxed at 40%. So it's again that difference. So if, for example, let's say I was a graduate and I'm going to apply for a job that is a 50K salary, right? So remember, I got £12,500 personal allowance, that's tax free. Then yeah, I'll be paying 20% on 12,501 to 50, let me backtrack. I'm applying for a job at 60K. I'm going to carry on. Yeah. Right? So I'll be paying 20%, £12,501 to £50,000 on that amount. That little chunk of paying 20%, and the difference between 50,001 pounds and £60,000, I'll be paying 40%. So it's not as mad as it seems. Some people think, oh, if I move up the tax bracket, so if I move from 20% to 40%, I'll be paying 40% across all my money, and that's loads of money gone. It doesn't actually work like that. So that's a big thing that I'd say to people. If you don't really understand, go and have a look. I do have a breakdown on pennies, pounds on the Instagram account, but just go and have a research and actually understand how income taxes work. And don't let that deter you from applying for higher paying jobs. Like, go and get the bag, go and get your job, and understand how income tax work. Yeah.
I think people should. I never really understood why kind of people said that, because to me it was really, I didn't know the intricacies, but it was really simple. More money means more money. Yeah. You know, so I just kind of went with that. But I've seen some tweets where people say that jobs should be advertised after tax. So the pay on the job should be basically after, I think, your NI contribution and the basic tax has been taken off. So it should be effectively the net salary that's advertised. What do you think about that?
I don't think it's necessary. I think people should just understand, because, I mean, yes, it makes sense. But the reason why they tell you it before taxes are taken off is for things like, for example, if I was going to go and apply for a mortgage, right? Let's say I have a £50K salary, right? That's what I'm on, let's say. But because the job was advertised to me post-tax, so it's showing me the net, which might be like 37, I think, roughly, that is, I'll be taking home. So now I'm going to the bank, they ask me, how much do you earn? I say 37K. I do, but I don't. Do you understand what I mean? Like, my salary is actually 50K. So really and truly, you want to go to the bank and say, I earn 50K, because then, you know, when you go for a mortgage, the bank will give you 4.5 times or 5 times that amount to be able to actually afford the property that you want. So there are reasons as to why they advertise it, you know, without taxes and NI contributions taken away. And it's just down to you as an individual to understand how income taxes work, and how much you actually be paying after that. Because I mean, even though yes, you can show it net, there are still different contributions which may affect how much you actually take home again. So on top of that, people make pension contributions and people contribute different amounts. People might contribute towards private health insurance. There's all kinds of things which again could lower actually effectively how much you take home. I don't think personally it's that big of a deal, but I do understand where people may be coming from.
Yeah, I think, and also they're like online calculators. You just put your tax code in and you put the numbers and it really does it for you. So
exactly.
I don't really understand why it's such a thing, but it's what the people really kind of like ask for. And in terms of like, say, I just finished uni, or I'm about to finish uni, and everything's about credit scores coming up because maybe I'm looking at buying a house or whatever else. So what do I need to know about my credit score, and how can I don't know, effectively improve it?
That's a good question. That's a really good question. So credit scores are really important if you're someone and you eventually want to get some line of credit. Some people aren't interested about credit scores when they're young. They're like, oh, I don't need it. But even for things as small as like getting a phone contract, you need to have a credit score. So it's really important now while you're young, while it's not maybe as important to you, to look at credit score and try to keep it at the best place that it can be. So when it comes, I think what I'll say first is when it comes to credit scores, I've heard before this thing where people say they don't want to check their credit score too much because it'll make their score go down. So to kind of briefly break that down, when you apply for any kind of credit, there are two types of checks that can be run, a hard check and a soft check. A hard check is often when you go to apply for a new line of credit, or you want to take out a new finance, or you want to apply for a new phone contract. The provider will run a hard check on you. So that's them doing a deep dive into your credit file. And that will likely have an effect, and it'll definitely will cause your score to go down if you get rejected from the application. So imagine I apply for finance and I get rejected, my credit score will likely fall because a hard search has been conducted and I failed on that application, right? Then the other one is a soft check. So soft checks are run by companies, but it's almost like service level. So they're just checking the basics, kind of like the public information with regards to your credit file. That's what they're checking. And that is often run when you're on price comparison sites. So imagine I'm going to check my car insurance, for example. Those companies will often do a soft check and say, right, from the surface, this is what it looks like and this is what we can offer you. Obviously, once you actually go forward and apply for car insurance, for example, then they do a hard check before giving it to you. But that's what a soft check is. When you go to check your credit score, you are conducting a soft check, and soft checks have little to no effect on your credit score. Like it's not even noticeable. So you could check your credit file once a week, so four times a month, and it won't have an effect, or very, very, very minute effect on your credit score in terms of it reducing or anything like that. So that's one thing I kind of wanted to spell off the bat. When it comes to your credit score, people always ask me, how can I improve mine? Number one is to make sure you're on the electoral roll, AKA make sure you're registered to vote. And that is because these providers come to your credit file to check who you are. And if you're not on the credit, in the electoral roll, they can't actually see that you're a real person. So you actually need to say, you know what, this is who I am. Yeah, so this is why you need to go on the electoral roll. Whether or not you choose to vote is your prerogative, but you need to make sure you're on the electoral roll. And likely, if you're not on it already, once you sign up, you'll see your credit score jump because now providers can verify who you are. You are who you say you are, right? So that's a big one. Number one, make sure you're on there. You can usually look on your local council to see if you've registered. That they'll usually tell you yes, you are, or no, you're not. So yeah, that's what I'd say. Number two is just make sure. Yeah. Number two, I'd say make sure you pay your bills on time. So again, it sounds like a given, but you'd be surprised how many people I know, friends personally, who don't pay their phone contracts on time and let it elapse and say, I'll pay it three weeks later. Try and pay those on time. Like I say this all the time, if you can, and you know, maybe your phone contract's coming up and you don't have money, you'd be better off borrowing from a friend or borrowing from a family member or someone close to you to pay that phone contract and paying them back than missing that payment, because that will have an effect. And people don't always, you know, believe me when I say that. I'll say, if you've ever missed a phone payment, go ahead and look in your credit file. You will see it on there. I promise you, I had a look and there was one when I first checked when I was like 21, when I was really going to do a deep dive. I saw a time when I was 20 or 19 back in like first year of uni where I missed it, and it showed up on my credit file. And obviously that is going to have a negative effect on your credit file because you've missed that payment. So try your best to pay all your bills on time. And obviously the likely one, which I say is pick this at your discretion, is to get a credit card, but only if you're responsible, please. Don't, I wouldn't advocate for it if you're a student. I've been through that myself. I wouldn't advocate for it if you're a student. Only if you're responsible and only if you know you're going to spend money on there and you're going to pay it all back the next month. So if you're not too sure if you're going to do that, or if you think you're someone who's too tempted to go online shopping, then I wouldn't say do that. I would not say do that. There are other credit builders like Lockbox, LOQBOX, which you can sign up for, which are credit builders. So work in a similar way as a credit card, but you're not actually taking out any credit. So that's what I'd say.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I think the credit card option is really funny. I always say, if you're shit at managing money, don't use that option, because yeah, you'll probably blow it. So just like avoid that. You know, one thing I've kind of come across is I was having a conversation recently about doing taxes and about how like at the start of every financial year, you should do your taxes. But I thought, so what I thought was that when you get paid from like your company or whatever, they take out your taxes, your net contributions and all of that, and that's you done. Then obviously you pay your council tax to your council, I guess. But what does doing your taxes actually mean? Because I've never actually checked whether that's correct, but that's just what I assumed it was.
Yeah, no, it's a good question. So it is, as you say, so when you work for an employer, the employer handles that for you. So as long as you're on the right tax code, which I definitely would say, if you're at a new job or you change jobs, make sure you are, because quite often you can be placed on the wrong tax code. And if you do find yourself in that position, call HMRC straight away and sort that out. But yeah, your employer, once you're employed, your employer will deduct any kind of contribution that you have, so NI and income tax for you, so you don't have to worry about that. So there is kind of no change. Your only change will come about if you are like a sole trader, so if you work for yourself, self-employed, or you have a limited company, which is a lot more technical. But yeah, if you are someone who, you know, works for someone or works for a brand or a company, then you don't have to worry about taxes. You get your payments every month or however frequently you get paid, and that is all taken care for you.
Yeah. What's your view? Because I know this really blew up during COVID. What if you're an international remote worker? Like, how do you get taxed then? Because I guess your employer is based in the US, they're not going to take out your UK taxes. So like, do you do that yourself or what happens?
Yeah, so that's a bit more technical, and that's a lot more explanation. But if you, so you're asking if you're from abroad or if your company that you work for is based abroad.
So basically, if you're living in England and your company is based in the US or anywhere else abroad.
Yeah, so I worked for a US company before. That is still handled on their back end. All I'll just say, just make sure that you have a good understanding of what should be coming out. So if you have any issues, flag it up as soon as possible, because I have worked for a US company before previously. But what I did is I just made sure that everything was correct. And if I did have any issues, which I had on the rest of occasions, I would just flag it up to them so they could get that sorted ASAP. But I'll just say, just make sure you're on your finances. I mean, I've always been that person anyway, but I think it's really important to know roughly how much am I taking home, especially if you work a job where you can do like overtime. Roughly know how much you should be bringing home, because I've heard stories of people who have done crazy hours of overtime and have been paid less than they regularly would.
And
they've realized months down the line, because they literally just were not watching their finances. Whereas for me, I keep a log. If I'm working with someone, I keep a log of, right, I've done this much overtime. So if I calculate that up based on like my hourly or my whatever it looks like, I should be bringing home this next month, and then you can keep track on it that way.
Okay. So I think this is, I just had a thought about this. So if that's basically, I guess, if the US or whatever country does the taxes for you, so does, I don't know whether you know, but does international remote working actually benefit the country you're in? So if you're from the UK, how do you contribute to the, like, to the UK economy? Because if you're paying the US taxes and probably only paying your council tax because of where you live, how else are you actually contributing in terms of your income tax?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. Well, it depends on how the company files. So some companies who are US-based may have still another base in the UK or in the UK island, so they may still contribute that way. If you are happen to live here, but you are working for a company who's solely based in the US or based abroad and paying taxes locally, obviously that company pays corporation tax because they employ people abroad. And you as an individual, even though you may not be contributing income tax, remember, when you buy stuff in the UK, we pay VAT. So you're contributing to, you know, our taxes there. There's all kinds of things. If you drive in the UK, you're paying road tax. There's so many different taxes that people don't always that you're paying. Yeah. While you're contributing to the economy, it may not be, like I said, directly injecting your income tax to the economy. Depending on how the company runs, it all depends on the company. And depending on how they run, you may not be injecting your income tax there, but you are still paying in many different ways. So wherever you buy in the UK, well, the majority of things have a VAT on it, which is value-added tax, you'll be paying that, which is at 20%. So you are still contributing.
Okay, fair enough. But from your personal opinion, between the US and the UK, I don't know how to phrase this question in an intelligent way, so I'll just say it how it comes to me. But between the UK and the US, which of the countries has, a better tax system? Or which one is more fair to the, like, to the citizens?
I think that's an interesting question. I don't know if I could answer which one's more fair, I think I could say which one I prefer.
Which you prefer?
Yeah, I prefer the UK, even though the US in general, obviously, I know that taxes vary from state to state. The US tends to have lower taxes in general, but in the US, you file your own taxes, which to me sounds like crazy.
And yeah, it sounds like a pain in the ass.
Yeah, I thought I was stressed out every single year and I'd pull out my hair, so I couldn't do that. And obviously, as you all know, the big thing, the US obviously pay for their own healthcare. Whereas here, I guess we pay more in income tax and taxes in general, but we don't have to worry about, if I need to call an ambulance, I don't have to worry about how am I going to fund the ambulance. If I need to call 999, I'm calling that and going to the hospital and that's all dealt with for me. So I don't have to worry about that. So for me, I think I prefer paying slightly higher tax, knowing that I've got those comforts. And obviously public services, we don't pay for here. I know some countries you do. So yeah, for me, I just would prefer the UK one. Taxes are automatically deducted. Public services are covered. Any kind of like your local councils are covered. If you need something changed or roads being redone, you have to put your hand in your pocket for that. So yeah, that's just me.
Yeah, because I watched a video on like UK versus US taxes, and like the cost of like effectively 999 and 911 is so different. Like in the US, it could be up to like thousands or three figures, like high three figures, for literally just calling 911, which is 911 emergency services. Which is a bit crazy to me, because I would like you said, I think paying more taxes, knowing you don't have to like kind of lose an arm to effectively fund like your own healthcare, that is better. So I think we'll move on to, in terms of like housing and mortgages, and what does a good mortgage look like, and where can like a new graduate effectively find one?
That's a good question. So a good mortgage is different to everyone. A good mortgage for me may not be good for you because of different circumstances involved, but let me just kind of step back a bit. So a mortgage is essentially a loan that you get from a bank or a builder society to be able to purchase a property. So you can have two types, two main types. In the UK, it'll be a domestic mortgage, which is a mortgage that you get as someone. So for example, I might get a domestic mortgage to say, I want this loan because I want to buy a house that I'm going to live in, or I could get a buy-to-let mortgage, which is saying I want this loan because I want to buy this house and I'm going to rent it out to make money. Those are the two main types of mortgages. In terms of what's a good mortgage and what isn't, it's subjective, because their applicants are different. People have different incomes, people have different needs, so that would look different to you. What I'd say is, if you're unsure as to whether or not you're getting the best mortgage, you can absolutely have a look for yourself. But what most people kind of recommend, and what I definitely say that you should look into anyway, is to getting some sort of mortgage advisor or financial advisor who can help you, because as a consumer, we can see a limited number of mortgages on the market. A financial advisor has access to every single mortgage on the market, and there could be a mortgage that is better suited to you that you can't see as a consumer, but a financial advisor or a mortgage advisor is able to have access to. So that's what I definitely recommend, and definitely encourage people to have a look. If you are on that journey and you get to that point where you're like, okay, I need to find a mortgage, even though you have to pay for a mortgage advisor, to me, it sounds like it's more than worth the money that you're getting, because you're able to find what's best suited for you.
Okay, well, how much is roughly I don't want to say good one, because that might be too expensive, but say an affordable one that's actually like quality for like the average university graduates?
Well, there are some, there's like this, the emergence of like these online ones. There's one called Trussell, they're online. I think their one is something like, I think it's like £99. Don't quote me on it, I could be wrong. I think it's around that kind of price range for them, and they will scour the market. So again, they're like a mortgage advisor, but they're just all online, and they will scour the market for you and find that. If you're looking for actually an in-person one, obviously I know it's COVID right now, so we're not seeing people in person, but when that does kind of come back, I think probably a good couple of hundred you'd be looking to. But that's kind of like the normal when you're paying like solicitor fees and everything. A good couple of hundred for each is what you should be having set aside to have access to these people.
Okay, fair enough. Okay, that's not too bad, because I know when people hear anything that has to do with hiring, they kind of get like, oh my god, that might be too expensive for me. But yeah, I think it's worth having a look, because yeah, you need, I think developing a culture of outsourcing some of these things to the experts can only be a positive. So in terms of money management, what to you personally, what are some smart investment options for young adults, especially in the UK? I know me personally, some of the ones that I haven't started, but I want to do is like investing in the stock market. I tried Forex, but it was a bit like it was a bit too difficult for me, because you have to like actually like focus, and I wanted something that's a bit more passive. But what do you suggest what are smart investment options for new graduates effectively?
Yeah, so it depends on kind of like investing slash saving. It depends on what your goals are, I'd say. But I'm just going to give you a few options for different points of life, depending on what your goals are. If you're just looking to invest and kind of like plotting for the future, whatever that may be, then you should have a look at like a stocks and shares ISA. So as you mentioned, wanted to be a bit more passive, a stocks and shares ISA is actually, let me explain what ISA is. An ISA stands for individual savings account, and that is a savings account like any other. The difference is any interest that you earn on the money in the ISA is tax-free. So there are different tax advisors, but a stocks and shares ISA is where you can put money into the ISA and it's managed by a fund manager, and that fund manager will invest it into a different fund for you. You can usually pick the funds that the money goes into, but that is how that works. You put money in the ISA and it gets invested for you. You can just kind of sit back and just check on it periodically. You don't have to sit there and watch the market or anything. So that's a good way to have a look at. You don't have to have like thousands of pounds to begin with. You can put in, I think when I opened up my first stocks and shares ISA, I put in like £20. Like, you don't need a lot of money to start off with. And what I like to do is, if you have those kind of investments, is just to maybe pick like a weekly or monthly deposit. So you might want to say, I'm going to start off with £50 and put in £50 every month. Or you might want to put in weekly amounts, but just kind of drip feeding that is a good way. But obviously, decide how you want to do it, because some platforms will charge you a fee every time you deposit, so it may work out best to put in your money in one big chunk, but obviously it depends on the platform you're using. So that's one way. If you are looking to save for a house, which I'm sure many people are, then I definitely encourage you in the UK to look at the Lifetime ISA. And even though it's not an investment per se, it's more savings, but it's geared towards your future. And the Lifetime ISA works is you can open it up with a minimum of £1, and you can put in a maximum of £4,000 per tax year. So the tax year in the UK runs April to April. You can put in a maximum of £4,000, and from there the government will give you a bonus of 25% on top of your savings. So it's money for saving. I don't like just it's just free money for your savings. Okay. And it's meant to be go towards your first property purchase or for retirement. So if you are looking to buy a house, then that's a really good option for you to have. So I definitely encourage you to do that. And then lastly, I would say, obviously depending on your age, but a really big one I think a lot of young people don't think about is pensions. So once you're over the age of 22 and earn more than £10,000 per year, you will find yourself, and you're working, you'll find yourself automatically enrolled in your workplace pension. And this is a really good option. I know it sounds like, oh, I don't want to be part of this. I'm not old yet. I'm still young.
Yeah.
But I promise you it's worth it. And I actually did a reel on this actually yesterday talking about it, because the workplace pension is a really, really good one, as most employers now have been like mandated by the government that they, A, have to auto enroll you, and B, have to make some sort of contribution. So you'll find that your employer will either match your percentage. So for example, let's say I work and I put in 5% of my salary or my monthly income into my pension. My employer could either match it and put in 5% as well of whatever I put in, or they could put in just a percentage. So I put in 5%, they put in 2 or 3% into my pot. But regardless, that's extra money that you're getting from your employer. And it's effectively like a pay rise. It's like extra money that they're giving you, even though you can't benefit from it immediately, you're having to defer the benefit, it's still extra money that you're getting from your employer. So I definitely would say, like, if you're thinking about your future, I know it seems like a long time away, but trust me, if you want to live a life of luxury when you're 16, sip pina coladas on the beach, that is what you should be looking to start doing as soon as you turn 22 anyway.
Well, preach. So lastly, what is, like, for you personally, like, what is one financial information or advice you wish you knew earlier?
Good question. I think for me, mine was probably, I wish I knew about stocks and shares ISAs earlier. So I remember I always wanted to get into investing, probably from when I was like 19. I realized that it wasn't just for rich people up in Wall Street. That's when I actually knew that you could actually do it as a regular person. And I didn't open up my first one until I was 20. But if I knew about it when I was like 17, I probably would have got it as soon as I turned 18. So that's mine.
Oh, so do you have to be 18 to effectively invest in that?
Yeah, but I do believe, yeah, for stocks and shares, you need to be 18 and over, yeah.
Okay, well, like, I've taken so many notes down. I'm like, yeah, I'm definitely looking to look into all these things you've said.
Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Please don't forget to like, share, and comment on this.